Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. The Millennium Trilogy by Swedish writer Stieg Larsson sold over 80 million copies worldwide. But the author died before the first book, The Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, was even published. However, that hasn't stopped the incredibly successful series continuing, almost from beyond the grave. My guest today has been able to uncannily channel Larsson. Indeed, his work on the follow-up books, The Girl in the Spider's Web and The Girl Who Takes an Eye for an Eye, have been hailed by many as better than the originals. Today we meet the Swedish journalist turned biographer and novelist who's responsible for probably the most hotly anticipated thriller this year. David Lagercrantz, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
I want to take you back into your own history because I think there's a danger of forgetting that whilst we focus on Lisbeth Salander and
yes,
the books,
yes.
that actually there is a real man behind
yeah,
this.
Yeah, well, I think I'm real.
So your family is very well known in Sweden. Why
yes.
is that?
My father was, you know, this high scholar, chief editor of Dagens Nyheter, who is sort of the Times, or even more, because that was an absolutely most influential. And he was the literary critics, and he was sort of, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre, if you go back. I grow up, with authors all around us, mm-hmm. and all nervous what he will thought about it. So he's really the demon in my life. So I've been fighting, you know, I've been in his shadow and I was the youngest kid, and for 10 years or so I was the only kid home. So I was very close to him and idolized him, but was scared to death. He wrote biographies of James Joyce or Dante and Proust and things, you know.
He's, of course, not the only demon in your life because the family's been dogged by a history of mental illness and suicide.
Yes, and that's, you know, what the Lagercrantz family is famous for. We have many gifted people, but we have so many people who have been depressed, and the overrepresentation of suicide in my family is really horrible. And I grew up with that, and I think my father said all the right things, but he had a sort of a worship for the suffering. There's, of course, in literature, we have this of the geniuses is the one who suffer most, and all the unhappy, you know, poets and writers who even Hemingway shot himself. And for me, that was hard coping with. I once got an advance for writing a book about my father, but I didn't finish it. And I had a title, Succeed or Go Under, My Lad. Because that was sort of the two ways of the Lagercrantz family. Mm-hmm. And the really dangerous thing in my family was that we really didn't say to it, but in some way we worshipped the suffering. So we had a family that you sort of, you know, weakness and sensitivity was something fine, you know, that was something noble in us. I mean, it sounds maybe strange, but we have this romantic and we were really worshipping all these suffering people, especially women, actually, of course, because they were not allowed to blossom as much as the man. So,
in terms of succeed or go under, clearly you've succeeded, but I wonder how your writing career began. Being surrounded, obviously, by all these writers who came to see your father must have been very influential.
Yeah, that was very influential. But, you know, I didn't dare because I wanted to write so deeply. And my father, he was sort of having his drinks in the evening. He was seeing TV. He said, oh, he's so ungifted. Oh, he's so mediocre. You know, it could be the prime minister or it could be
because he
famous.
Was a good friend of Olof Palme,
yeah,
wasn't
yeah,
he?
Yes, yeah. yes. He was famous. He knew all about them. And I was starting to think if I am one of the ungifted, mediocre people. Think if I... So I was sort of scared to death. I mean, think of, I tried to write a novel and no publishing house said it was crap or so. So I think my way of escaping was, you know, writing, but doing the opposite way. He was highbrow, you know, and I went to, you know, journalists and crime. And I start my career in the tabloids, writing crime journalists. And that was certainly not a thing you should do as a member of the Lagercrantz family. Mm. But I did, and maybe that was good in the end.
Your real breakthrough came with your ghostwritten biography of
Zlatan Ibrahimovic.
So
yes.
He's a very famous footballer.
He's the biggest icon we ever had in Sweden. He represents New Sweden. And you can't even imagine how he is. I mean, we used to say we have Zlatan Ibrahimovic and then we have the king. So that book actually was a huge success.
So you say he represents the new Sweden. In what way?
Sweden changed, of course. I mean, we had a lot of immigrants and I'm very proud that we are, you know, allowing people changing. And there were not many. We were writing about the immigrants and the problems and the suburbs. He was the first American dream in Sweden, fighting his through. He grew up in very harsh circumstances. So what I really saw was not, you know, a story about football. It was the first journey from the ghetto to, you know, stardom and his fight. And I think that was part of it because I saw a guy that was sort of destiny to go under or be a criminal or something. But instead of going weak or being a criminal, he just gets stronger and he fight. And there is similarity from other characters that I have written about, Alan Turing or Lisbeth Salander. Yeah.
Well, the book was shortlisted for the William Hill Sports Book of the Year Award. It was nominated for the August Prize in Sweden. It's gone on to become a bit of a Swedish classic.
Yeah, it is a classic because they use it in school. I mean, the wonderful thing about the book was that it got, you know, all these young kids who never been even near a library bookshop to start reading. And that's one of the most beautiful thing that ever happened to me. And that was the crazy thing because if you go back again to my family, you know, the highbrow family, ghost writing. I mean, that was the lowest of the lowest, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But this book was actually shortlisted for the most prestigious prize, and that was something absolutely new.
Do you think that the reaction to that book reflects the changing attitudes in Sweden?
Yeah, I think so, really. I think so. And there were so many people thinking that he was un-Swedish, that he was arrogant. We used to have a sports star like Björn Borg, you know, there were silence and it didn't say much, it didn't show feelings. And now we have a new guy. So in the beginning, say he's un-Swedish, you can't behave like that. But when we had the book, we sort of understand why he had to be like that. And we understand how difficult it is for the immigrants, you know, force the barrier to get into society.
And to fight against right-wing elements within the
country.
Yes,
of course.
And of course, right-wing fundamentalists played a large part in Stieg Larsson's original books. And we've seen the rise of it in Sweden, haven't we?
Oh, yes, it's horrible. And Stieg Larsson really, I mean, back in his days, there was a few lunatics. And then I think he saw what was coming. And now we have them, I mean, they're not Nazis, but we have a party that is partly racist in the parliament. So Sweden, in one way, is the most tolerant country, I think, in the world. We are wonderful in many ways, but the intolerance on the other side is growing.
So, how did you come to carry on Larsson's legacy?
Well, shan't talk too much, but I'm sort of schizophrenic what I will do in life. I tried with the Alan Turing book to be highbrow, and then it was the Zlatan book. And then after the Zlatan book, I tried to write a novel of my own, more highbrow, you know, fine literature, blah, blah, blah thing.
One worthy of the Lagercrantz.
Yeah, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, yeah, sort of. And my wife, who is very kind, of course, and lovely, but honest, said to me, David, it's a bit depressing. I think that the hero in the book's complaining too much. You sure you're not using this book as therapy? And I sort of, wow. And I said that to my agent. I don't know, maybe I'm this crazy author who is best when I collude myself with someone else. And then I saw my agents, Magdalena Hillers, eyes sort of goes, and then they called, you know, the Larsson family and Norstedts publishing house. And then one day they said that I have to come to their publishing house and I have to go into the, not in the main entrance. I was smuggled into the basement and in the room without the window, they asked me, would you, David, consider writing the fourth book in the Millennium series?
That must have been just an incredible moment. I mean, did you think that you might not do it at any point?
The strange thing is, I didn't hesitate a second or a nanosecond because, you know, I'm an old reporter. I was a crime reporter and I had the same feeling when I have an absolutely fantastic story. You know the feeling? I felt, you know, fever in me. I sort of went, yes! And I think that they felt that I was not in, you know, for the money, oh, this will be good. They felt the passion because they were not sure then that we were starting the discussion. Mm. But when they felt my passion, I think that then they dared to do it.
When you ghostwrite a book, so for instance, with your football book, you were able to meet the subject, you were able to talk to him. But how do you get into the head of a dead man?
Well, I have his books. So you just read them over and over and over and try to understand them. Why is their book so good? And how does he work? And we shift in perspective. And then I started to write, you know, and it was hard to find the codes for the characters, Lisbeth Salander. And I was just trying and trying. But after a while, I had to stop reading the books because otherwise I can't check how did Larson solve that.
Mm.
So I think that was the mission from the beginning. Learn the books, you must recognize the universe, but put yourself in it. So it should be, they said to me, a collusion. Larson's word, of course, but also mine.
I mean, you've been applauded for perhaps, as I said, even being better than the original.
Well, I don't know about that, yeah.
But keeping those characters constant must have been absolutely key. I mean, people have very strong feelings for the heroine, Lisbeth Salander,
yes,
don't they?
Yes. I mean, she's an icon. She's one of the biggest icons we had, you know, the sort of last century. So I'm still nervous, you know, will I do her justice? But what I thought that I will sort of deepen her mythology, like sort of like Christopher Nolan did with Batman. So I was trying to answer questions that Stieg Larsson didn't have time. Why is he such a good hacker? And now, why does she have a dragon tattoo on her back? Mm. Sort of deepen the thing that created Lisbeth Salander and add maybe something to her, more darkness or whatever. Yeah.
I mean, were there any research notes? Did he leave any kind of maps of the way forward at all?
No, I haven't seen anything of it, but I could see threads in his book. When you read them very thorough, you could at least guess what he were going.
Yeah.
I mean, he mentioned the evil twin sister, Camilla, that she was beautiful, manipulative, and the father's favorite. So that was three keywords when I sort of tried to model her.
Yeah. Do you identify with the journalist Mikael Blomkvist at all? And do you think that Larson did?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's hard to identify. You can be obsessed with Lisbeth Salander, but it's very easy to project yourself. I'm certainly not as good journalist because he's absolutely brilliant, but he's not that clear character. I mean, he's just like you and me, you know, a nice man with good values. So I suddenly understand that he has stopped smoking. Because Larson smoked, and then it's very easy to put a cigarette in his mouth.
Mm.
And I don't smoke, so he suddenly stopped smoking. So it's sort of small things from yourself you put in him.
Yeah. Do you think that you and Larson, perhaps both identifying through this central figure in the book, would have been similar to each other? Would you have been friends?
Well, I hope so, because I would, you know, admire him. And I'm dreaming of waking him up and telling about him all about his success. But I don't think we were very similar characters. And that was something that I thought of about in this book, working about what creates us, the genetics and the social surrounding. And there was a lot of discussion that I was from this privileged Lagercrantz family and he was working class. I think we have many similarities, the nerdiness and the passion for and against fighting intolerance. But I think we were different persons in many ways.
One notable difference is that your books don't seem to be as violent as his.
No, I'm terrible in fighting, of course. You know, I've never been, even as a kid, you know, I can't stand too much violence in books as well. And I thought something happened, you know, after Hannibal the Cannibal. There was, you know, sort of a pornographic even. So I always try to work more on the intellectual riddle because I'm hard cutting body parts. You know, I can't do it. I don't have it in me.
Now, of course, successful films made of the Millennium Trilogy.
Yes.
Were those your source material too?
Not really. I try not to be too, you know, influenced by them. I've seen them, of course. But I think they exaggerate her character, and I'm thinking about that too much. They make her too much of a punk warrior. I mean, she's absolutely an underdog, a punk or a goth, or she has her tattoo. But Lisbeth Salander is really not a girl who cares so how she looks. She doesn't care what people think of her. So I think they, you know, sort of exaggerating, you know, with this hair coming up. So I try to create her in my own head.
I wonder what the reaction of his friends and family were. Obviously, the publishing house was absolutely thrilled that you could do this. But there was a long-running dispute, wasn't there, with his partner?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the sad part. And it's really, it breaks my heart, in a way, that they haven't reached a settlement. So,
what's the story behind that?
It's just, I mean, they weren't married, and there was a legal battle about the rights, and one of the reasons they weren't married because there were security reasons. He was fighting extreme right, and now the
he
father...
He died without a will, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yes, yeah. He died without a will, and now the father and the brother tried to, you know, reach a settlement, but she thinks that she owns the rights. It's sad, it's sad. So I said it many times, for me it's been a thrill of my life, but this sort of broke my heart. So I have the deepest feeling for her, even though she may be angry at me, you know.
I read some quotes from her, which I can see would be very troubling for you in your position, saying that this is all about money and she feels it's kind of like grave robbing.
Well, I respect any kind. I think you should discuss literature. The border of literature is what you can do. Icon figures still live on, and they will live on even more because there are certain icon figures that connects to us. What I know for certain is that this is good for Stieg Larsson's authorship, because the beautiful thing is now that the young generation is reading his books again. And there will be a big motion documentary coming out about his life yearning. So his character lives on, his books finding new readers, and we will see what a hero he was, fighting intolerance, racism, extreme right. So it's good for his authorship, that I know for certain, and that, you know, is a comfort for me.
You mentioned meeting Le Carré earlier.
Yeah.
and of course, this isn't the first time. There's been a franchise of this kind of thing. If you look at Fleming, James Bond.
Oh, yes, 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 of course, yes.
Yeah.
And I think Lisbeth will be that. She will be a better James Bond because you could discuss his value. You know, he's not the best feminist in the world, is he?
Certainly not.
Certainly not. But Lisbeth is. She's the feminist icon. Yeah. So I really hope that he will live on forever.
Yeah.
I mean, she's in the caliber of, you know, Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
She was something new that's changed crime fiction.
Why do you think that was, though? Was it just the changing attitude?
If you go back in those years when he came, you know, women, they were victims, you know. They were beautiful women finding raped and dead, and they needed, of course, men to rescue them and protect them, and they had all these motherly thing that women should have. Lisbeth was something absolutely new. She didn't need any man or anyone. She didn't care. She didn't have to please men. She was an underdog, and society tried to crush her, but instead of getting weaker, she got stronger. It's so much about her. I mean, she's the female cowboy, but again, with a lot of better values than the old cowboys.
Sure.
She's on her own, and she was something new. And then you have this mental thing. She's antisocial in a way. And now we have characters like that all over. I think that's important for young girls now growing up. They feel they must be beautiful and please the man. And, you know, Lisbeth is such a good role model. Mm. She doesn't care.
Except that she's also extremely violent, breaks the law, takes drugs, eats badly.
yeah, but that's what makes her interesting.
Yeah.
But yes.
Yeah. You touch on other social issues. For instance, there is an attempted forced marriage in the book. Again, really important issues to be discussed within the context, not just of Swedish society, but generally.
I wrote about honor-related violence, and because I've met many girls who have met that, you know, they're not allowed even to love or to live. And I think that's horrible, and that certainly is Lisbeth Salander thing. And she is from Bangladesh, and I'm a board member of PEN, you know, the organization. And there is so much, you know, the free speech is under attack. Mm. And in Bangladesh, you know, we have people that they can just say, they could like an article about evolution theory, and that's enough to getting killed.
Yeah.
So it's horrible, actually. So I think I'm following Stieg Larsson's tradition to have contemporary issues that you must fight for. And I will do that now, giving money to, you know, investigating journalists, because we need it more now than ever when, you know, so much lies, anti-democratic forces in society, disinformation. We need heroes like Mikael Blomqvist, investigating journalists, and certainly hackers like Lisbeth Salander, because nowadays the worst hacking attack is done by states, influencing elections and all of that.
Which direction do you think Sweden is going? Do you worry for Sweden's future?
Yes, I do. I see a young generation who's very wise, because they grow up now in a multicultural society. So I have hope for the younger generation. But there is a lot of intolerance and afraid of foreigners. And maybe it's the same, bit of the same with Brexit. Wasn't the older generation who voted for Brexit? I see Sweden is in so many ways such a lovely country for all kind of, you know, minorities, sexual or ethnic or whatever. But of course, there's another side, and it's growing. And this party, the Sverigedemokraterna, who has his roots, you know, from the fascists, in the polls now, they have over 20%, and that worries me as hell.
But of course, as you say, through your books, you are addressing these issues, you're highlighting them, and perhaps it's a way for people to access this information without having kind of politics rammed down their
throat. I hope so.
The book has done incredibly well. I mean, I've got the latest one, The Girl Who Takes an Eye for an Eye, in front of me. It must be an odd feeling to have this success. Obviously, you were a successful writer beforehand, but this extra level, the celebrity from the springboard of Larsson.
I will always be grateful to Stieg Larsson, because I know it's a privilege, it is. But it's very strange, because in many ways you're still the unsecure teenager, even though I'm 55. You know the feeling? So sometimes, is this me? You know, I have this long queue of people wanting me sign. It's a sort of, what? That's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, it just sounds incredible. I mean, just how many interviews a day are you doing?
I don't know. When the releasing day, I look at my watch and it was 10 in the morning, and I've done 6 TV interviews and three radio interviews, and it was 10 in the morning and I was continuing.
But what is it, do you think? Why are people so fascinated by this?
I absolutely don't know, but of course it's the Millennium Universe, and part of it maybe is the controversy, should you do this? And it gets people crazy, especially in Sweden.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think it's ridiculous, because there is certainly more important news than I'm coming out with a new book. Certainly, but I'm still on the headlines, so it's crazy.
Do you think that you can go back to writing your own work, perhaps that abandoned novel?
I will certainly do that, because I've noticed I develop as a writer when I try new things. I respect those writers who sort of write the same book all over, but I develop when I do something absolutely new. So I know that after the third book that I'm writing right now, I will do something completely else, you know, when I feel the fever again.
David, finally, have you made your family proud? What do the Lagercrantzes think?
I don't know. My father is in heaven, but I think they're happy. And I have small kids, and they are, I mean, I've been touched by the divine Zlatan Ibrahimovic, and that's the most impressive thing for my footballer 9-year-old.
The Girl Who Takes an Eye for an Eye, which continues Stieg Larsson's Millennium series, is out now. It's published by Maclehose here in the UK. Many thanks to Daphne Karnitsis and George McDonough. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, and you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.